Okay, hi everybody, and hello to all of you out there in television land, for those of you who remember that. Let me start right in. Let's go back into ancient history in the world of the internet, all the way back 7 years to 2005. So remember what was happening in 2004, 2005. There was a revolutionary technology that was going to change university education forever. Right, and that, of course, was the iPod, right? Not the iPad. That's today. It was the iPod, and this is an article from the Chronicle for Higher Education, which was talking about the experiment at Duke. Duke made a deal with Apple to give iPods to every member of the freshman class, and what the freshmen were supposed to do with this is revolutionize education by recording and listening to and sharing educational materials. And the article you're seeing over here is 1 year after that experiment, where what it's writing about, it turns out that all the upperclassmen at Duke were really pissed that the freshmen were getting these free iPods and they weren't. So Duke and Apple extended this to the whole undergraduate body and everybody was happy. But there was a problem. It turned out that what these students were actually doing with these iPods was recording, sharing, and creating educational materials. And out of the woodwork comes a helpful intellectual property attorney. Right? Isn't it wonderful how there's always a helpful IP attorney coming out of the woodwork? Right? Do they have permission to copy these things? They might not. And have professors realized how easily this stuff could end up on the internet? And I read this, and I had a vision, right? Napster, right? Students all over the world, in flagrant, illegal disregard of intellectual property laws, learning. And a couple months later, when the RIAA went and sent nasty letters to MIT, as they did to lots of universities, you might remember, I looked at this article in our newspaper and kind of imagined, gee, suppose it was that. And 5 years ago, or 7 years ago, this was a joke, a weird joke. And it's not a joke anymore. Right? What happens when those calculus lectures are locked up in some kind of learning management system with student IDs? What happens when this stuff is marketed and sold? What happens to our conception of the university? Because what's going on right now is a war, a real war, that is about the future of the academy. And we are starting, as IT administrators, as faculty, as student leaders, falling into the rhetoric of that war. Here's one of my favorite examples. This goes all the way back to 2002. And this, again, this was in response to the RIAA and Metallica sending letters to universities. And this is one of the most amazing statements I've ever seen by an educational administrator. This was sent to all USC undergraduates. And look at what it says. It says, as an academic institution, USC's purpose is to promote and foster the creation of intellectual property. Now, I would have thought that as an academic institution, USC's purpose has something to do with education. But apparently not. Not only is the statement false, it's worse than false. It's the wrong frame for thinking about what a university is. And what's happening now is a battle between the traditional view of academia, which is about empowering people, educating them, letting ideas blossom forth, and this other thing, which says the university is a kind of factory and a kind of market for something called content. And the appropriate thing to do with that content is make sure that it's handled efficiently and put in the hands of people who know how to manage this and package it and do all sorts of wonderful stuff with it, as opposed to people who don't understand its value, like faculty and students. And it's important that we remember there is another kind of dynamic that we need to think about that resists this sort of marketing, manufacturing view of what education is. So I want to talk today about openness in the academy. And I'm going to give four riffs on it. I'm going to talk about open educational resources. I'm going to talk about the university policies we can adopt to support openness. I'll talk about legal frameworks. And then I'll come back at the end and kind of challenge all of us and ask, are we really ready to be open in the academy? And I'm going to give an MIT kind of spin on it, because that's what I know best. And actually, MIT started, has a good history in starting some of this. For MIT, the story of open educational resources really starts with OpenCourseWare in 1999 and 2000 and 2001 when we were designing it. And OpenCourseWare kind of said, MIT is going to take all of the educational materials from which our faculty create courses from students, and we're going to put that online for everybody, for free, forever. And it has the kind of things you see listed on the left side. There's course syllabus and calendar and exams, problems and solutions. When we first put this up, we got wonderful mail from faculty all over the world saying, we love it that you're putting up your exams. Please take down the solutions. And we wrote back, no, no, this isn't about us doing our work for you. It's about you seeing models of what we're doing. OpenCourseWare is pretty successful now. Here's the statistics as of last month. When we started, we said there were something like 2,000 MIT courses, and we've surpassed that. So you see there are a bunch of active courses and courses being taken down. We work with translation partners, so there are a lot of course translations. For places, often in sub-Saharan Africa, which don't have internet connections, we will just mail out the entire thing on a hard drive. So there are a lot of mirror copies running, and about 80% of MIT faculty are participants in OpenCourseWare, meaning that the course they are teaching actually is represented in OpenCourseWare on the web. Our traffic, these are our statistics for last month. So we get about 2 million visits, a lot of page views. What's interesting to us from MIT is we got last month 41,000 visits from inside MIT, and considering there are about 15,000 people in the MIT community, that's pretty good. And our videos are doing pretty well. You see there are a lot of downloads. We put them on YouTube and iTunes and all over the place. About half of the traffic comes from North America, half from out. So that's a story, a little snapshot of OpenCourseWare. And of course, it's not just about MIT. There's an OpenCourseWare consortium, which is a bunch of universities who are joined in putting their educational content up. It's got over 200 members and about 20,000 courses. What that is, what that was, is the genesis of open educational resources, which I hope you've all heard about, which is this vision. Right? It's this vision that there ought to be educational materials that are around for people to use, and more importantly than just use, to build on, to remix, so that the whole of humanity becomes uplifted by the ability to use the very best of what we all create together. Right? That's a vision. The vision that there ought to be universal access to the content of the world's great learning institutions. Universal open access so people can remix and build on it. That's one vision. And there's a companion vision to it, which I hope you've heard about, which is the idea that not only for educational materials, but for research results, for research, for the scientific progress that people make, there should be universal access to those collective intellectual resources of the world's great institutions. That was a thing we started about the same time as OpenCourseWare. At MIT, it's called DSpace. And DSpace is MIT's institutional repository. Here's a little bit what it looks like. You can go to it, and then you can pick a piece of it. You can pick the computer science and artificial intelligence lab, which is my part, and then you can drill down in that, and you can see the selections that are there. It's broken up into communities, and I can look at one of the communities, and there I see the publications from that. I can pick a publication from the community. I can look at it, and there's a page that says what it's about, and there's a very important thing on that page, which is that. That is an address to something called a handle. A handle is a permanent URL. So if the servers start moving, that URL stays static. And what that means is you can now use that as the basis of a citation. So that says that this paper sitting in MIT's institutional archive can now be cited as part of the scientific literature. And of course, if you go there, there's the paper. This is kind of an interesting paper. It was an internal memo at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory. And now it's out there for the entire world as a thing that can be cited as people start writing papers that reference it. And of course, this is not just about MIT either. DSpace is put out as an open source platform, and it's been pretty well adopted. You see, it's been taking off. There's over 1,000 instances right now. And DSpace kind of grew up and merged with Fedora Commons to form a thing called DuraSpace. And in fact, there's a talk, I think, tomorrow or this afternoon about DuraSpace. Anybody know? Should go to that to think about institutional repositories. So from the point of view of this talk and the way I think about it at MIT, there are two really nice things that got started. One was the OpenCourseWare vision, which has grown up and is turned into open educational resources. One is the DSpace vision, which has grown up and turned into institutional repositories. And the very, very nice thing from the point of view of a couple of us at MIT and sort of like-minded people over the world is you no longer have to explain what these are. So 12 years ago, there wasn't open educational resources, and there wasn't really institutional repositories. And now universities are moving into this space, into this world of really sharing and opening their doors to the rest of the world. And what I really want to talk about in this talk is why. Why is it that universities should support open educational resources and institutional repositories? And one reason is that if we as universities don't do this, the idea of what an academy is, of what a university is, the sense of academy is going to become increasingly marginalized in this factory creation control content world. And the university communities are going to be, as a result, increasingly stressed. Let me give you my favorite example of that. This comes from Office of the General Counsel, University of Texas in 2001. And it turns out that as faculty, you know, we have a problem. I certainly like it when students sit in my lecture and take notes. But you have to understand that if those students are sitting there taking down notes and they're writing more than just the basic facts, they're writing some of my creative expression as I teach, they're engaged in copyright infringement. Now, how do I think about that? I mean, I do want students to take notes, but who am I to condone copyright infringement in the university? And this is the problem that the general counsel at UT is talking about. And like very, very good general counsels, they come out with the obvious solution, which is you ask your students at the beginning of the semester to agree to a license. And there's the suggested license, right? My lectures are mine. They are protected by copyright law. They are my original expression. You are authorized to take notes, which, of course, are a derivative work of my lecture. And that extends only to one copy for your personal use, right? You're not authorized to record my lectures, and you can't provide them to anybody else. Okay, Mary, what did Hal Abelson talk about in class yesterday? Oh, I'd love to tell you, but it would be copyright infringement. Okay, now, when I say it that way, it's a joke. But is it a joke when those notes are on an LMS? Is it a joke when the university is paying per license for these educational materials? This stuff that was a weird fantasy of what might happen 12 years ago is now becoming real as we bring in the kinds of educational infrastructures that we all want to bring in for the very, very best reasons. There's a wonderful way to think about this if you're interested in this fight over the ownership of educational materials. A wonderful book by Corinne McSherry, who wrote this when she was at Stanford Law School 12 years ago, and she now works for the Electronic Frontier Foundation. And what she says, the problem is that in U.S. law, pretty much there's only one way to talk about respecting the integrity of materials, and that's by using the rhetoric of property. And when we do that, we start conflating academic freedom with property rights. And the more we start talking about our educational materials in terms of property, the more we risk losing the idea of what a university is and losing the idea that the university can justify itself by anything other than economics. So I highly recommend this book to you. Why else should universities support educational resources and institutional repositories? Well, the future of the academic record is being decided right now. And if we expect universities to have any say in how that comes out, we have to start supporting these other alternative initiatives that look at the stuff we do through a lens other than property and ownership. Let me give you an example. Look at how scholarly publishing works. And let's describe it as many people do describe it, through the vocabulary of property. How does it work? Well, scholars give their property away to the publishers. That thing that used to be your article is now Wiley Blackwell's article. You gave it away. And that sounds so weird that in order to keep the system working at all, the publishers will magnanimously grant you back some limited rights to this thing that used to be your work, which is now theirs. And those rights are determined totally at the publisher's discretion and can change at any time. The university, which some people would have thought had something to do with the creation of the scholarly work, generally gets no specific rights in this. And if you thought this was about the public, well, you're at some other planet, because the public has nothing to do with this. Now, how does that happen? Right? All of you who are doing scholarship do it. You might not realize it. That copyright transfer form, you are legally giving that to the publisher. Right? You're giving away the rights of copyright, which include, you know, not only to distribute and reproduce it, but to make derivative works. The right, for example, for you to come up and give a talk about your own article, because that's a derivative work. And then there's various limitations that get put in to make the system at all plausible. Right? This is a contract. What I suggest you do the next time you're asked to read a copyright transfer form, read it. Hardly anybody does. Look at the rights you're giving away and look at the rights that you retain. They really do talk about whether you can use it in teaching, whether you can distribute to colleagues, whether you can put it in an institutional repository. And these have been changing over the last 5 or 6 years completely at the discretion of the publisher because everyone signs that contract. Here's an example. This is the current publication agreement of Wiley-Blackwell, which basically says you may not post that article you gave them, which is now their article, you may not post it on the web. You can, and the only part you can submit is the original manuscript you submitted to the publisher before you made revisions based on the reviewers. You can reuse it in non-commercial publishing only up to 250 words of text. We're talking about citing your own article. This is the stuff that we all give away when we sign that form. Those are restrictions on the author. Conversely, what do the publishers do? They license this stuff back to university libraries. And there are restrictions there. So Springer, in its license with university libraries, prohibits the libraries from doing automatic indexing. ProQuest prohibits data mining. And we all know, right? What are we talking about at this conference a lot? Data mining and analytics. We all know where that's the value. The publishers know that too. So one of the reasons they want to own all this stuff is to prohibit anybody else from realizing that value by putting up those services. They're not stupid. They know where the money is. In other words, what's happening is we're moving towards private monopoly control of the scholarly record. And I mean that quite literally. I mean monopoly control. If you look, here's a history of 10 years of mergers in academic publishing. There are now four, maybe five top publishers. Right? Wiley grew sixfold in 10 years from 1998 to 2008. Elsevier grew ninefold. When Wiley bought Blackwell, they paid 16 times earnings. You're seeing real traditional standard monopoly dynamics. And where does the monopoly come from? The monopoly comes from the fact that if you have a top scientific journal, if you are publishing Cell, any university library that's going to say they support biology research at all has to buy Cell. There's no price elasticity, totally elastic price. Any researcher who is looking to get tenure wants to publish in Cell. There's a complete lock-in monopoly. And you can see the effects of that in pricing. Right? If you talk to any of your librarians, this is these are some data from MIT, sort of a decade ending in 2006, that blue line you see sloping up, the dark blue line, that's the consumer price index. And that purple jaggy line is how much the MIT libraries spent on books. And the green line and the yellow line are the numbers of books and numbers of journals the MIT library subscribes to. And that red line is what the MIT libraries have to pay for essentially that constant number of journals over the decade. It's classic monopoly pricing. Price of journals has been going up over a decade at three times the cost, three times the rate of inflation. Right? Flat out monopoly. And it's amazing, because after all, we, the scholars, are the ones who are producing the articles. We, the scholars, largely through our libraries, are the ones who are buying the articles. Right? These public, a place like Elsevier makes something like a 40% profit margin. This is going on the backs of the libraries, and you're probably seeing this. You're probably getting memos from your university library saying, which of the following journals would you be willing for us to cancel? And the reason for that is the cost of the library's raw materials is going up at three times the cost of inflation. How is it possible? I mean, what a crazy system. Right? How is it possible that the system persists? And what you have to realize is that there's a tremendous inequality of power in this. That copyright transfer agreement is structured as an agreement between the publisher and the individual faculty member. And, you know, what's an individual assistant professor supposed to do when Elsevier sends an agreement and says, you know, if you don't assign us the copyright, we're not going to publish your article. Right? It's a no-brainer. You don't have a choice. And the way out of this is to start having the faculty think about itself as a collective body, not just as individuals. And we are dreadful at that. Faculty are horrible at thinking of themselves as a collective body. And that takes me to the next topic I want to talk about. I want to mention university policies. What can universities do to get themselves out of this bind? And I'll talk about faculty open access mandates. There's the MIT's open access mandate, which starts out with a brave statement, a brave abstract wave the flag statement about how the faculty's committed to disseminating its research and scholarship as widely as possible. And then come the teeth that says that when you are a faculty member at MIT, you automatically grant MIT non-exclusive permission to make your work available for open dissemination. So this is before you send it to the publisher, before anything, just by being a faculty member. This was passed unanimously at MIT, which I tell people means both people who came to the faculty member meeting approved it. MIT was not, oh, here's a heroic statement that came out from our chair of the faculty about what a great signal this was from MIT. MIT was not the first place to do this. I think University of Kansas was the first place. Our open access mandate is closely modeled on Harvard. We take that stuff and we put it in our institutional repository. So these things, OpenCourseWare and DSpace Institutional Repository, start fitting together. And about a quarter of MIT faculty papers are now in our open access repository. And there's starting to be other places that are creating mandates. University of Kansas, as I said, I think the first. Harvard. The most recent one was Bucknell, which I think passed their resolution last week. And Princeton did it the previous week. There's the Chronicle for Higher Education reporting on Princeton's. What do you need to make something like this work? Because you need an interface to allow the open access materials and the open educational resources to interface with the world of copyright and legality. So that's the third element in thinking about open access in the academy. And those are the legal frameworks. So the other piece of this puzzle are Creative Commons licenses. So Creative Commons, again, was an organization that started about the same time. And these were licenses that are specifically designed to promote sharing and sharing on the Internet. When we started it, we were all sitting around and saying, well, what might be evidence of success in doing Creative Commons? And we sort of said, well, we think maybe if there are a couple of million works, that were licensed with Creative Commons licenses, we'd be happy. At the moment, there are now about a third of a billion licensed works on the Internet. And Creative Commons is trying to become the recognized mark for openness and sharing on the Internet. There's a family of licenses that you can choose from. You can say, gee, I want people to attribute my work. I want people to either be able to use it for commercial redistribution or only for non-commercial redistribution. I want people to, they can distribute it how they want, except it's only under the same terms at which they got it. That's called share alike. And then these licenses are designed so that you go to the Creative Commons website, you answer a couple of questions, and then it picks from the collection of Creative Commons licenses the one that describes what you want. You get an icon that you can put on the web page. The icon is a link to a human-readable license. In Creative Commons, we create licenses in three forms, one for human beings, and one for lawyers, and one for machines. So this is the one for human beings. That links to the version for lawyers, which is an actual real license that a whole bunch of copyright lawyers pored over. And that license links to metadata so the machine can recognize it. And I hope you learn more about Creative Commons. Cable Green. Cable around? There's Cable in back. Cable is Creative Commons' czar of open education. And you're giving a talk tomorrow, right? Okay. So please go hear that. And he'll talk a whole lot more about open educational resources. Okay. So this is all a very nice story. You see open educational resources growing. You see a movement that says universities should step up and create institutional repositories. And you see a general legal framework around Creative Commons licenses. And it's growing and growing and growing. And of course, that means it has enemies. And so what's happening right now, you remember the quote that's attributed to Gandhi, right? First they ignore us, then they laugh at us, then they fight us, then we win. We're right now getting into the they fight us stage of open educational resources. It's gotten past the point where it's easy. So one group fighting back, of course, are the publishers. The publishers are looking at these institutional mandates, and they are fighting back. So several months ago, Elsevier, for example, put in special discriminatory language in its copyright agreement to single out universities like Harvard and Princeton and MIT and Bucknell and Kansas that have faculty mandates. And what it says is that you as a faculty member can put your paper which you're now giving to the publishers, you can put your paper in an institutional repository provided that the university is not asking that to happen systematically. So it means right now, a faculty member who signs that copyright agreement at some arbitrary university without a mandate has more flexibility than faculty at those universities. You might question the legality of such a phrasing, and in fact, a bunch of university lawyers are looking at that now, trying to figure out what to do. But that's an example of fighting back. And of course, the journal publishers, although they're giant companies, are infant children compared with the publishing industry as a whole. There's a bill right now before the House Committee on Appropriations, which is drafting the legislation for Health Human Services and the omnibus funding bill. So it doesn't have a number yet. They're still drafting the bill, and the bill contains specific language in it which would not allow any of that funding to go for the development of open educational resources. You can get the gist by reading the yellow words. Right. None of that funding, if the draft gets accept, if the language gets into the draft, none of the funding in the next appropriations bill will be able to use to develop materials unless the Secretary of Labor certifies that that stuff is not being prepared or developed for licensing or marketing. Okay, and you can imagine the lobbyist dance that's going on in Washington right now. The publishers have a very, very large and powerful lobbying group. So we know this story, right? This is, in some sense, a very typical story. It's a story that we can all tell. It's a story of disruption through technology. So you can read this as saying there are these old business models which are now getting changed through technology. And it's kind of working out. It's all disruption, and it will work out. And for the last part of my talk, I want to turn that back on us. So it's easy for us to talk about the business models of the publishers. It's easy for us to talk about the business models of the purveyors of educational content. It's easy to say technology is disrupting that, and it's a great story, because we all know that we're on the side of truth and light, being the Academy. What happens when we get disrupted? What happens when we, as the stewards, the guardians, the wise directors of university IT infrastructure, what happens when the power of the network and the power of openness starts challenging the way that we do business? And I just want to leave you with three kinds of images to think about, which are just appearing. The first one you may have read about is the very large artificial intelligence course that's coming out of Stanford, which last August, when John Markov wrote this article in the New York Times, the big news was that they'd gotten 62,000 people who'd signed up for this open artificial intelligence course from Stanford. They opened last week, and by then they opened with, I think, 162,000 people who were taking this course. But the interesting thing about this course is that it wasn't really from Stanford. There were two absolutely outstanding leaders in AI, Sebastian Thrun and Peter Norvig, who are unquestionable, outstanding faculty and leaders. But they didn't do it through Stanford. They started this tiny little company. They recorded some lectures. In fact, in a very low-tech way, there's an example of one of the lectures. This is Peter talking about making inferences about Chinese vocabulary by identifying words on menus. So it's very, very cheap production values. They distribute the video through YouTube. They write interactive exercise software and distribute that by going to a company that will rent you a whole bunch of virtual servers, which will expand as much as you want. It's pretty cheap, and it's done totally outside Stanford's infrastructure. Now, how do you feel at the thought? When we made OpenCourseWare, we sat around and we had meetings for a year, and we got funding, and we did all this stuff, and we put up a big publishing operation, and that's part of MIT that still runs it. That kind of stuff can now be done by individual faculty without even going through the university. So how do we, as IT people, understand that it may no longer be the case that the most effective way to get educational materials out into the world is to do it through a university infrastructure? It might be the right way is you just let individual faculty go off and do what they want, and we, as people running the IT shop, maybe we should just step aside. And maybe there's so much open educational resources out on the net, which there already is. Everybody knows that when students want to learn stuff, they go to Google. They don't care about the university at all. Maybe we should start recognizing that. Maybe we're just not the, maybe we running university IT infrastructures aren't the best way, either for faculty dissemination or for students getting materials. How do we feel about that? Are we prepared for that kind of openness? That's about universities disseminating materials out. Are we prepared for the other kind of openness, which is universities getting materials in? Here's a nice example that, again, has just started at MIT in our software engineering course. What you're seeing is a piece of homework in writing a Java program. So there's the student's work on the right. And on the left, you see comments happening. So there are tutors and coaches and mentors who are commenting on the student code. But the cool thing is, where do those mentors come from? Some of them are TAs in the course, a very small number of them. But actually, right now, there's about 100 MIT alumni and other people, because they can sit on the web, can do this commenting. Can you imagine that expanding? How do you think about the fact that communication and open technology and the power of the net effectively allows us to enlarge our instructional staff to the point where the people who are in some sense providing instruction to students in the university aren't even members of the university? And again, this is something that pretty much any faculty member at a university can now use commodity technology to set up. How do we feel about that in the way we think about the future of the university? And let me leave you with the third issue, because, of course, all of this stuff is happening at the same time there's an enormous disruption in university infrastructure through mobility. So if you're not currently right now redesigning your university infrastructure to use mobility, you will be this year and next year. So that's a whole change in the platform that's happening. And I wanted to show you one. This is what's happening are university mobility frameworks. You can see examples of some of them upstairs as you walk through the exhibit hall. And these are frameworks built by a particular company called Moto Labs. They've got a booth up there. You can look at it. And the framework makes it really easy for people to add in things like directory services and new services and scheduling things and when the campus bus runs and all of that stuff. But it is way more super modular than we're used to doing. And it becomes easy to add these little mobile applications and make them part of the framework. And the interesting thing to me about this is a lot of that stuff is being done by students. So here are three examples, one from University of Vermont, where the app that does the university news was actually done by students. Right? One from Brown, where the part of Brown's infrastructure that deals with the campus radio was done by students, and at Commonwealth College, the actual whole thing was done by students. So again, for those of us who are doing university infrastructure, how do we feel about the fact that the pieces have now become so modular that the creation of services, of the real services inside the university, might not be being done by the university staff who are supposed to be doing that? So again, how do we think about that? Oh, and I just wanted to say, just to end, it can be really easy to create mobile infrastructure. Let me just show you a piece of something that we've been developing at Google. This is a thing called App Inventor, which makes it very easy to make little mobile applications. That's Karen. She's about to make a little application that's kind of a hello world. It puts up a picture of a cat on your phone, and you touch the cat, and it says meow. So she says, I want to create a project. I'm going to use it with my phone plugged into the computer by a USB cable. She says, I'm going to put a button on the screen. I'm going to tell the button it should look like a picture of a cat. And there you see the cat on the screen. I'm going to add a sound. And now I'm going to go to something. If you know Scratch, this is a programming language like Scratch. I'm going to say when you click the button, I'm going to play the sound. Download that to the phone. And there's the app. If I had the sound up, you could hear the meow. That's something that we've developed at Google over the past year. That's now being transferred to MIT. And starting early next year, you'll be able to use App Inventor as a public service from MIT. And right now we're working with some educators debugging that and getting it going. And we've just started at MIT the MIT Center for Mobile Learning, which is combining that App Inventor you saw, programming language Scratch that you might know about, and then a lot of work from the MIT place called the MIT Education Arcade, which deals with augmented reality gaming. So that's just a sort of hint. You can go upstairs at the Google booth and you can see something more about App Inventor. But the point I wanted to make here is that it's easy to build this mobile technology. At the same time, the universities are starting to use modular frameworks for that mobile technology. And what that's going to mean is loss of control by the university IT organization in what happens at the university. And now you sort of have to ask yourself, you know, are we open and embracing that loss of control, or are we fighting it? So let me just end with a summary. Universities really, really have core institutional reasons to support openness, to support open educational resources, to support open institutional repositories. The infrastructure for doing this is really there. These are not now major difficult things to do, but by being really there, we have entered phase three, right? They ignored us. They laughed at us. They are now starting to fight us. It's the point where it's getting hard. And it's not only challenging some very powerful industries, notably scientific publishers and general educational publishers. It's getting to the point where it's even going to challenge our own sense of what the academy is about. Where are we going to be as this unfolds over the next decade? Okay, thank you.